Jonathan Pollard is the only American ever convicted of spying on his own country for Israel, a close ally of the U.S. Pollard spied for Israel while he was working for American Naval Intelligence. This gave him access to classified documents, thousands of which he turned over to Israel, including U.S. reconnaissance photos of PLO headquarters in Tunisia. Those photos helped Israel bomb the headquarters in October of 1985. When Pollard realized the Americans were onto him, he and his wife fled to the Israeli embassy seeking asylum. But to their shock, they were thrown out. The moment they left the embassy, they were arrested by the FBI. My guest Wolf Blitzer is the Washington bureau chief for the Jerusalem Post. Blitzer, who is an American, has been covering the Pollard case since the story broke in November of 1985. He's written a new book about this spy scandal and its repercussions called Territory of Lies. Blitzer was the only reporter allowed to interview Pollard while he was in prison awaiting sentencing. Blitzer interviewed Pollard twice. The first interview took place on November 20th, 1986.
Actually, I had tried to get in to interview him shortly after his arrest a year earlier, but on the advice of his lawyers, Pollard didn't grant any interviews. He was taking a very low profile. He was going to cooperate eventually with the U.S. government and plea bargain, and then participate in the interrogation and the polygraph and the damage containment. He didn't speak out publicly. Only one side of the story really was coming out, the government side. And Pollard, while sitting in prison, was increasingly getting upset because he felt that his motivations had been distorted. He wanted to make clear that he was not motivated to become a spy for Israel by the money. The money only came in later. His original motivation was ideological. He felt that vital information, which Israel needed, was not being officially shared by the U.S. government with Israel, and he decided to do it on his own. He wanted to get that message across, and after some discussion with his wife, his father-in-law, Bernie Henderson, actually came to my office early in November of 86 and told me Pollard's side of the story, which really, as I said, had not come out, and suggested that I make another attempt to get into the prison to interview Pollard, and I did. I called the warden at the federal prison in Petersburg, Virginia. I wrote letters, and to my surprise, Pollard agreed, and the warden agreed, and I managed to get in and spent 3 hours with Jonathan Pollard on November 20th, 1986.
Now, you were allowed in and allowed in with a camera and a tape recorder. Why was it so surprising to you that you'd be allowed in so easily?
I was surprised because nobody had been in the prison. No reporter had been in the prison to interview Pollard in the year that after his arrest. And secondly, as part of his plea bargaining agreement, which had been released publicly earlier in June of 86, there had been a stipulation in there that he could not talk to the press or write articles or write books or disseminate information based on his years in naval intelligence without the authority of the director of naval intelligence, given the fact that he still had classified information presumably in his head. And Pollard had signed that agreement, which in effect made it possible to interview him only with the authority of the director of naval intelligence. And I assumed that the director of naval intelligence was not going to give that kind of authority. But I did manage to get into the prison, which is run by the federal government. The Bureau of Prisons is part of the Justice Department. So I assumed that when I got in, it had the authority of the U.S. government, obviously.
So that raises the question, which you've tried to come to terms with in your new book, were you used?
It does raise that question, and in the end, I've concluded that, yes, I probably was used.
By who and for what reasons?
I was probably used by both sides. I was probably used by the U.S. government. They let me in. I think they were, A, interested to see what Pollard would tell a reporter. B, I think they were interested in seeing if he was going to technically violate that plea bargaining agreement because he personally did not have authority from the Director of Naval Intelligence to give that interview. And the government eventually did use that in trying to convince the sentencing judge to impose a harsher sentence on Jonathan Pollard. I was also used by Jonathan Pollard because his side of the story, as I said, had not come out. He wanted to express his sadness that the Israelis had not only abandoned him but eventually betrayed him, and he was befuddled, he said. He was confused. And he wanted to underline, as I said, the point that he did not do this for the money. So I think both sides tried to use me in getting their sides of the story out. And I don't feel as if I betrayed any confidences or acted unprofessionally or irresponsibly. I think any reporter, especially a Washington-based reporter for an Israeli newspaper, covering this case from the moment that it exploded a year earlier, if granted an opportunity to interview the principal player involved, the spy, if you will, he or she would have grabbed that opportunity, and I, of course, did. So in the end, I may have been used, but I don't think that I acted irresponsibly or unprofessionally.
Do you think that your interview might have affected the outcome of the sentencing?
I know the judge was very angry at Jonathan Pollard for granting me those interviews. He made a big point on the day of the sentencing, on March 4th, 1987, the judge in castigating Pollard for going ahead with those interviews. And he even recalled that Pollard did not even inform his own lawyers that he was going to be granting me this interview. It deeply angered the judge, and the government used it successfully in that respect. But my sense is the judge was much more influenced by the government's damage assessment, which was conveyed in camera, a classified 46-page document signed by the then Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger, underlining the worst-case scenarios, the damage done to U.S. national security. I think that was much more important in convincing the judge to impose this maximum sentence on Jonathan Pollard than the interviews that he granted me.
Didn't the judge also say that he was struck by the lack of remorse that Pollard showed in his interview with you?
He did. He cited the fact that Pollard felt as if he had been a loyal son of Israel or an Israeli pilot. He gave that kind of an analysis. And the judge didn't feel that Jonathan Pollard had really shown a great deal of remorse in the course, not only of the interviews with me, but in his own personal statements to the judge, as in written statements to the judge, as well as in his personal statement that he made in the courtroom on that sentencing day.
So would you do a pre-sentencing interview again after your experience with the Pollard interview?
Yes, if the person who is being sentenced wants to speak out, as Jonathan Pollard clearly did, and B, if the U.S. government, the prison authorities, invited me in and allowed me to bring my camera and my tape recorder, and it was clear that this was an interview that was on the record, that was going to be published, if both sides say, in effect, that they don't have any problem with this kind of an interview, I don't think a journalist should be involved in a self-censoring decision like that and say, well, I don't think this is going to be helpful for either the government or for the defense, and not go in there and do the interview. I don't know any journalist who would turn down that kind of an opportunity, especially on a very, very sensitive and important story as this whole Pollard affair was.
Wolf Blitzer is my guest. He's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Jerusalem Post, and he's been following the Jonathan Pollard case since the story broke. His new book about it is called Territory of Lies. You were talking a little bit about how your story with Jonathan Pollard compared to the information that had already been made public. Another angle in your story was how he thought that Israel had abandoned him.
He was shocked, to put it mildly, when I first interviewed him. He had been arrested as he unsuccessfully sought asylum at the Israeli embassy on November 21st of 1985. He was actually on the embassy grounds but was kicked out and immediately arrested by the FBI. He was trying to protect Israel even after his arrest. He dissembled, he made up all sorts of lies about the involvement of other countries in order to protect Israel. Israel, the Israeli government, in its panic and in the shock that developed in the days and weeks immediately following his arrest, agreed to cooperate with the U.S. government in the investigation. And a team of U.S. investigators and prosecutors, State Department officials, intelligence community officials, went to Israel to receive evidence, to receive information about the Pollard operation. And those Israelis who were directly working with Pollard, his handlers, did testify against him. And the Israelis, in fact, made 163 documents available to the U.S. They returned 163 of the documents that Pollard had taken. And all of this was, of course, brought to Pollard's attention immediately after their return to the United States and Pollard's lawyers. And he was dumbfounded. He couldn't believe that his own handlers, the people with whom he had worked for an 18-month period, had so betrayed him. It was really unheard of in the annals of international espionage that a country whose agent had been captured, that country then went ahead and cooperated in the arrest and in the indictment, if you will, of that particular agent. He couldn't believe it. He felt not only, as I said, abandoned, but he felt betrayed. He didn't realize that the Israelis had at that point concluded that he, Jonathan Pollard, was expendable, that there was a much bigger issue at stake for the Israeli government, namely the entire fabric of the U.S.-Israeli intelligence cooperation, the whole U.S.-Israeli relationship. And the old adage at that point from the Mission Impossible show clearly was evident. If you are captured or killed, the secretary will disavow any knowledge of your operation.
Well, I think we're really not used to stories of somebody spying on an ally. Well, usually the other way around.
Right. Normally, we hear about normal espionage when countries spy against their adversaries. In this particular case, it was what they call in the intelligence business friendly espionage, countries spying on their friends, which is widespread. I want to make that clear. Countries, of course, spy on their adversaries, as they must, but they also spy on their friends, because it's important as well. A friendly country can certainly do things that could be damaging. Friendly countries occasionally get information which they don't want to share with another friendly country. All countries are reluctant to share any information which could damage their own security. The United States, when it comes to spying on its friends and allies, does it in an inobtrusive manner, in the sense that high-flying reconnaissance photography is used, satellites, or intercepting of communications. That kind of stuff goes on, not only against Israel, but against England or Canada or France or Japan or Mexico or any other country. It's part of the rules of the game. But going beyond the accepted rules of the game is when you actually run an agent in a friendly intelligence service. That is supposedly unacceptable, except there is one caveat. If that person happens to be what they call a walk-in, somebody who volunteers, somebody who comes to you and says, I have vital information which you need, which my country, my government doesn't want to share with you, it's very hard for any country, whether it's Israel or the United States or England or any country, to necessarily automatically reject a walk-in. Walk-ins are a separate category in and of themselves, and Jonathan Pollard was a walk-in. He approached the Israelis. The Israelis didn't approach him. He came and said, I want to help you. They checked him out. They were nervous. There was some concern that he may be a plant. It was a sting operation, some Israelis feared. But after checking him out and discovering that he was the real thing, that he had incredible access, they made sure that that walk-in didn't walk out. And that's when the money came into the game.
Now, he had access because he was working for the Anti-Terrorist Alert Center in American Naval Intelligence. And he thought that America was holding back information from the Israelis that the Israelis should have for their own security. What do you think, having analyzed the information that's been presented so far, was the U.S. holding back documents that they should have been sharing with Israel?
The question is should. I mean, that's the key word. There's no doubt that the U.S.-Israeli intelligence cooperation is widespread. Both countries share a great deal of information with each other, maybe 80 or 90% of what the other party would like to know, they share. But no two countries, no matter how friendly, share everything. Certain information is reserved. Certain information you don't share with an ally, because even in the process of sharing that information, you could damage what they call the sources and methods, the way the information was collected, whether it was collected through an agent or collected electronically by breaking codes or intercepting communications. And in the process of sharing sometimes information, you could tip off a hostile third party that party had been penetrated one way or another. And so some information you don't share with anybody. Secondly, you never share with any country, no matter how friendly, the sources and methods, how the information was collected. There's no need to share that kind of information. Israel would never share it with the United States, and the U.S. would never share it with Israel. A third reason why sometimes information is not shared, and this motivated Pollard to a large extent, is that even if information is authorized for release to a friendly country, and he did see in the course of his work some information that was authorized for release to Israel but was not given, the reason it was not given is that in the course of this intelligence cooperation, it's usually a quid pro quo arrangement. You scratch my back and I'll scratch yours. The U.S. will ask Israel for certain information and Israel will respond. depending on how forthcoming the U.S. is on other information that Israel wants. So sometimes countries hold back certain information because they want to use it as a carrot to extract other information from the other country. So there's a variety of reasons why some information would not necessarily have been shared with Israel.
We were talking about spying on an ally. Tell us a little bit about the kinds of documents that Jonathan Pollard turned over to Israel.
Well, most of those documents dealt with Arab military capabilities and Soviet weapon systems that were coming into the Arab world. They were technical documents for the most part. They were very, very important as far as Israel was concerned. Some of the early documents dealt with serious chemical and gas warfare production capabilities, locations of plants, and these kinds of things. Extremely sensitive information, which the U.S. had collected in various means and which Pollard made available to the Israelis.
When Pollard first approached Israel to spy for them, he was turned down by Mossad. The people who picked him up was, tell me if I'm pronouncing this right, the acronym is LACM.
LACM.
LACM, thank you. And this is the Defense Ministry's Office of Scientific Liaison.
Since Pollard's arrest, it's been disbanded. But it was a small scientific intelligence gathering unit in the Defense Ministry run by a veteran Israeli spy, Rafi Eitan, a 40-year veteran, someone who had been involved personally in the capture of Adolf Eichmann in Argentina in 1960, someone with a long history of espionage. And one of the master spies of Israel. He was in charge of this intelligence gathering unit in the Defense Ministry, which decided that it was appropriate to go ahead and run Pollard.
I guess one of the questions is, how high up did this knowledge go? How far into Israeli security did they know that there was an American spying for Israel?
Rafi Eitan says that he did have authority to run Pollard. He doesn't say where that authority came from. He has been silent on that. My sense is he did have a built-in authority. He felt he had a built-in authority, and I guess you could make a case that he had that authority. The top ministerial leaders at the time, the prime minister, the defense minister, the foreign minister, they all denied that they had any knowledge of this operation. They also denied that they gave any authority to it, of course. And the two commissions of inquiry that were established in Israel, one chaired by Abba Eban, who was then chairman of the Knesset Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee, the Israeli parliament, and a second government-appointed commission, the Rottenstrauch-Zur Commission, both concluded that Rafi Eitan ran Pollard on his own and didn't have authority, and he bears the responsibility for this decision. What undermined the Israeli argument that this was an unauthorized rogue operation is that shortly after Pollard's arrest and conviction, Rafi Eitan was granted a major job in Israel. He was given the chairmanship of the Israel Chemicals Company, the largest government-owned company in the country, which didn't seem to the U.S. as much of a punishment for him. And the other thing that undermined Israel, of course, and undermined Pollard tremendously, was the fact that Pollard's first handler, an Israeli Air Force colonel named Aviem Sela, was named to become commander of one of the largest Israeli air bases exactly on the eve of Pollard's sentencing. And it didn't look as if Sela was being punished either by getting this plum assignment. He, at that point, was on the fast track to becoming commander of the Israeli Air Force. So the whole issue of whether or not this was a rogue, unauthorized operation, of course, was blurred by the behavior of the Israeli government itself.
Do you think that the Pollard story is still damaging relations between the U.S. and Israel?
In the intelligence cooperation, there is still a very, very bad feeling on the part of many American officials. They felt they were burned badly. They operate on what they call the cockroach school of espionage, namely that if you see one cockroach in the kitchen, you better believe there are a lot of others in the plumbing hidden somewhere. And they're suspicious about that. They worry about whether there are other Pollards. They worry if there was a so-called Mr. X, another U.S. Intelligence official feeding information to Israel. They don't have any evidence. They've been searching for this Mr. X now for 3.5 years. They haven't been able to find him. But if in fact there was such a person, which the Israelis strongly deny, But it has left a bad taste. Now, having said that, I will also go on to say that fundamentally, the overall U.S.-Israeli relationship remains strong. It's a relationship of friends and allies, and it's very close in terms of economic, military, and political cooperation. But there's no belittling the enormity of the Pollard affair. It has had a lasting impact on the relationship, even though some of the worst aspects of it have been contained.
Do you think Israel will ever step in on Pollard's behalf?
There's no doubt in my mind that the Israelis would very much like to see Pollard paroled and deported and allowed to live out his life in Israel quietly. Many senior officials in Israel feel very guilty that they were not only forced to abandon Pollard, but eventually to hang him, to provide information to the U.S. that was used against him. They know there are other Israeli spies out there in the world and sitting in dangerous spots in the Arab world and elsewhere, who are waiting and watching and very carefully monitoring what Israel can do to help Jonathan Pollard, who, after all, from the Israeli point of view, was a loyal agent. He wanted to help Israel, and now he's paying a tremendous price for that decision. But I have no doubt that the Israelis would like to get Pollard to Israel at some point down the road. He will technically become eligible for parole, Jonathan Pollard, after serving a total of 10 years, meaning at the end of 95, early 96. Whether or not, of course, he gets parole is another matter. But my own guess is that ironically, given this close overall U.S.-Israeli relationship, at some point down the road, both countries will have a tremendous desire to get this a tragic episode once and for all behind them and to move on. And at some point down the road, I suspect there will be a political deal tying up all of the loose ends, including getting Pollard to Israel. But that's going to take some time.
Are you still in touch with Pollard or his wife, Anne?
I've written to both. It's very hard to get in to the prison. The only other reporter that did get in to see Pollard after the sentencing has been Mike Wallace of 60 Minutes, who did get in and was forced to sign some agreements that the Naval Intelligence would be able to review anything that Pollard said and delete from broadcast some information which could damage national security. But I've made repeated requests to get in to see Pollard again, to see his wife, and I've been routinely turned down. I've been in touch directly with the wardens of the various prisons, with the Justice Department, with the Bureau of Prisons, and I haven't been successful, although I've tried.
In your book, you say that you've thought of Pollard as the son of the American Jewish community run amok.
When I first met Pollard and I heard his motivations, and he went through his whole background in South Bend, Indiana, where he was a kid growing up, small Jewish community. He was one of the only Jewish kids in his public school and high school. His father is a distinguished professor at Notre Dame University, head of the Cancer Lab Research Institute there. When Pollard told me about the fights that he used to get into, the other kids picking on him, calling him anti-Semitic names, when he told me about his frustration in college, in graduate school at Stanford, and then at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University in Boston, when he told me about his frustration in wanting to go and settle in Israel, join the Israeli army, become an Israeli fighter, and his parents discouraging him, telling him, finish college, get a job, don't go, not wanting to lose him to a foreign country, even though they were tremendously supportive of Israel and identified with Israel, they wanted their son here in the United States. And when Pollard went through his own love for Israel, his high school science program, he spent the summer between his junior and senior year in high school at the Weizmann Institute of Science in Rehovot in Israel, where there was a program for gifted kids, and he really identified with Israel. Israel was really a manifestation of his Judaism. It was more than the actual religious aspects of being a Jew. He really identified with Israel. And this notion of wanting to help Israel, it just dawned on me when I was hearing his side of the story in the Petersburg Penitentiary that day. I just said, you know, this Jonathan Pollard seemed like a son of the American Jewish community run amok, that he just went off the deep end in his own passionate commitment to Israel, and he did things that he certainly should not have done.
You've been covering this story for the Jerusalem Post. Do you want to compare how this story has played in Israel and the United States?
Well, in terms of the facts, it's basically been roughly the same. But in Israel, there is a much greater nowadays grassroots sympathy and support for Pollard. They feel, the public, at least wide segments of the Israeli public, feel that the government mishandled this whole operation. They feel that Pollard was betrayed and made a scapegoat, if you will, and he was the spy left out in the cold, that the Israeli operatives who were involved managed to escape and they're living in Israel. Pollard was never helped in terms of his escape, and a lot of people in Israel, in fact, are sympathetic to him. And I would say that's probably the biggest difference, the amount of sympathy for the Pollard family in Israel as opposed to in the United States.
My guest, Wolf Blitzer, is the Washington bureau chief for the Jerusalem Post. Do many of the people who just know you by your byline assume that you're Israeli?
Yes, because I've been writing for the Jerusalem Post for about 15 or 16 years. They assume I'm an Israeli. I'm not an Israeli. I'm an American, originally from Buffalo, New York. But because I write for the Jerusalem Post, they simply assume that I'm an Israeli citizen. I don't have Israeli citizenship. I just have U.S. Citizenship.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your time. I'm very appreciative.